First of all, let me thank David for having invited me here, and Liz also for arranging tomorrow's workshop. I'd also like to thank the Unitarian Church for allowing us to use their space. I was here last year, and I really appreciate the simplicity of the architecture and the domed ceiling, which is actually very reminiscent of the earliest Buddhist temples in India, which were also this shape roof, which you can still see in the rock cut caves in Ajanta and elsewhere. And also, earlier this year, in March, I was in America and spoke to the Unitarian Universalist Buddhist Fellowship. And I was asking John on the way over whether the Unitarians here were also connected to the Universalists. It appears not. But in the States, it's a very thriving congregation. And a lot of them have Buddhist chapters. So at this convocation that I spent a weekend addressing, there were about 200 people. And many of them were Unitarian Universalists, for the most part. Many of them were also Zen priests and other things. So I think the spirit of this space and this movement is very much in keeping with the sort of approach that I think we need to consider for Buddhism. And as Buddhism tries to find its, or as I prefer to call it, as also David does, the Dharma, as it seeks to find its way into modernity, the West, I don't like the word the West, it's a little bit out of, it's a bit past itself by day now, East and West. I mean, really, I think the big issue for Buddhists, whether they be people who are interested in practicing the Dharma here in Europe or America, but also now, likewise, in China and Korea and Japan, and Thailand and Burma, the same kinds of issues and questions are coming up for Buddhists all over the place. How do we come to terms with, let's say, the natural sciences? How does Buddhism come to terms with modern philosophy and psychology? To what extent are we committed to, as Buddhists, to somehow preserve aspects of Indian cosmology, for example, that may not fit too happily with our current understanding of the world? How do we find, ultimately, a voice? How do we find an idiom, a language, that speaks to the kind of condition in which we find ourselves today? As the Quakers say, speaks to our condition. And this for me has been really part of my ongoing struggle, wouldn't be too mild a word, really, too strong a word. How do I come to terms with the practice of the Dharma, the Buddhist teaching, in a context which is quite un-Buddhist? Buddhism has had no impact on our culture until about 150 years ago. And one of the things that perhaps is most, I would say the most striking and perhaps most the most influential thing that has occurred in the 40 years since I've been involved in Buddhism is the widespread adoption of mindfulness practices in all areas of contemporary life, particularly healthcare, but also in education and in other fields as well. And again, this is not a peculiarly Western thing. These interventions and these approaches with mindfulness are likewise now spreading widely in Asia as well. So something's going on. in terms of this dialogue, this conversation. And those of us who work as teachers and writers, communicators, artists perhaps, find ourselves continuously trying to find a language in which we speak in a way that doesn't require jargon or every third word being in Sanskrit or Pali, that doesn't call upon the need to believe in, let's say, reincarnation or different realms of existence or reading people's minds or whatever, but nonetheless speaks with integrity and finds a voice that resonates and, in fact, I would say, must be rooted in the early canonical traditions. And in some ways, Buddhism strikes me as being like one of those very elaborate Bavarian castles, you know, the sort of things, I mean, lots of towers and turrets and all kinds of elaborate decorations, often standing on the top of a mountain somewhere. And one can be very impressed with the architecture. But at the same time, the complexity of the building and all of its evolutions over the centuries makes it very difficult to see on what that edifice was built in the first place. And in some ways, I think Buddhism is a bit like that. The different traditions that we encounter, be they Theravada, or be they Tibetan, or Zen, or Pure Land, or Nichiren, or whatever it might be, have evolved over the centuries in very beautiful forms, forms which are ideally fitted to the cultures in which they emerge. But when they suddenly, and Buddhism has arrived in modernity suddenly, although that might be rather impressive, these forms and structures and so on, it's very difficult to see, you know, on what that, those structures are built. So I think one of the things that has preoccupied my own work in the last years has been very much a quest for origins. Where does this stuff come from? Where does the idea of mindfulness, for example, have its beginnings? Who was this man we call the Buddha? What sort of world did he live in? Well, who were the people that he taught and had to deal with in terms of sponsorship, in terms of protection? What was the political, social, religious environment of his time? And I think if we cannot really get a clear handle on those particular issues, it's quite difficult really to understand how to interpret the teachings that were given, all of those 2,500 years ago. We need to see, I feel, how these teachings and these characters lived and worked in the context of their time. And one of the things that I feel that modernity allows us are the tools, the intellectual tools, the scholarly tools, that are making this early world of Buddhism more, more visible. We have historians and archaeologists who are getting a much clearer picture of the situation in India in the 5th century BC, where the Buddha lived and taught. And we have other scholars, philologists and others, who are examining the earliest texts we have at our disposal to try to come to a clearer understanding of what was probably there at the earliest period and what would have been subsequently built on to the teachings over the ensuing centuries. And so the strange thing in some ways is that to see what we might need now and in the future from the Buddhist tradition, we might actually have to go back to its very sources. And that's, I guess, in a nutshell, what my own work is very much about. Needless to say, this is a somewhat ambitious and at the same time highly tentative and incomplete work. It's a work in progress. But I think it's a very stimulating, even exciting time to be living. I think we are witnessing the actual transition of the Dharma from one context, that of traditional Asian societies, into a different context, that of our secular world, in which we have grown up and in which we live today. My own sense is that the Dharma has not at all exhausted the possibilities it has to reinvent itself. Buddhism has survived, I would argue, not because it's preserved something essential in an uncorrupted way that's been passed down from generation to generation over history, but that it has had the ability to reimagine itself, the flexibility to adapt itself to the new circumstances in which it finds itself. And in some ways, one of the curious parallels between Buddhism and Christianity is that both of these traditions primarily flourished outside of where they originated. Buddhism failed in the end to survive in India. It was more or less gone by about the 12th century AD. And likewise, Christianity didn't really flourish particularly in Palestine. But both movements had an enormous impact on the cultures of the countries and the continents around where they grew up and into which they eventually spread. And I think in both instances it shows that these are teachings and practices that are not addressing the needs of a particular ethnic group, for example, or a particular kind of culture, but are speaking to the condition of all human beings who are born, who get sick, who grow old, and who die. And that, I think, has very much to be where we start. That, in many ways, I feel that the Dharma, and I'm going to stop making comparisons with other traditions. In many ways, the Dharma is a way of life, a way of thinking, a way of communicating, a way of living ethically in this world, by which we are helped to come to terms with our own life and death. And I feel that it's very central in one's practice to constantly return to these primary questions. What does it mean to have been born? What does it mean to have to die? What is this strange but fleeting experience of humanity? This condition we find ourselves in. Right at the base, not our role we might have in society or in our families or at work, but our basic humanity. There's a passage, well, not a passage really, just a statement from Dogen, who was a 13th century Japanese monk, who went to China in order to train in Chan, or as it's known in Japanese, Zen. And he went, took a boat across to the mainland, spent a year and a half in China, studied with a teacher in a monastery, the name of which I forget, came back to Japan, and when he was asked what he had learned, he said, What I have learned is that the eyes are horizontal and the nose is vertical. Now, one might just dismiss that as a typical bit of Zen frippery, but actually, I think it's saying something rather profound. I'm not quite sure what, but what it does, in a sense, pin down is the basic fact of being a human being, with eyes that go this way and a nose that goes that way. That's, in a sense, the great matter, as the Chinese call it, of one's practice. And I think if we keep returning to that primary question, what does it mean to live here? How do I do it? Then I think we won't lose touch with the sources, both of our own inspiration, you know, what moved us in the first place. I assume that some of you, maybe all of you, practice Buddhism of one kind or another, maybe not. But whether or not you call it Buddhism or the Dharma, what is it that in the depths of ourselves drew us to these ideas in the first place? In other words, where did this quest that we find ourselves on begin? And very often what happens on this quest is that we find a Buddhist organization or a Christian church or whatever it might be, and discover an enormous sense of relief that finally, here's somebody speaking a language I can understand. Finally, this is a practice I can actually do. And we then get involved in this tradition. But the shadow side of this process is that very often that process leads us to become somewhat complacent and comfortable in our practice. And the practice can often become somewhat routine, maybe even a bit mechanical. We belong to a nice little circle of friends who all do and think the same things, etc., etc. And in the course of time, we begin to forget why we're doing it. I was teaching a retreat at Gaia House recently, and one evening when Martine was giving a talk, I went off to the local Union Inn in Denbury for a bit of refreshment. And there was a sign behind the bar in the pub that said, "Beer is the answer, but I can't remember the question." Now, of course, this is meant as a silly sort of pub joke, but coming out of a meditation retreat, it actually struck me. It really has stayed with me, this silly piece of text. And because I think often that's what happens with meditation. Yeah, meditation is the answer, but I can't remember the question. And I'm very much aware in my own practice that that's often what happens. I'm quite good at meditating. It's not difficult anymore. But at some level, it's lost touch. It loses touch very easily with what prompted it in the first place. And I think these primary questions don't get answered, although sometimes we like to think that perhaps they have been answered. But I think such primary questions always remain at some level in our life deeply alive. They're living questions. In the Korean tradition, in which I trained in Song, which is what the Koreans call Chan or Zen, they make a distinction between a living word and a dead word. And the main practice in Korea is to ask yourself a question. And the question is, what is this? And part of that practice is to keep that question alive. In other words, to ask that question from your soul, from your heart, from your body, they say. They say you should ask this question with the marrow of your bones and the pores of your skin. Again, that sounds like a nice idea, but when you sit down in the Zendo and start doing it, you find that very often all you're doing is just reciting a set of words. What is this? What is this? But it doesn't really have much purchase on the actual question itself, which is you and your life and your breath and your being here in this moment. So how do we prevent a practice from becoming, as it were, a dead practice, something that we just repeat with a certain degree of competence? And to what extent does our practice remain a burning issue for us, a real living question? So when we come to rethink the Dharma for our time, it's a matter very much, I think, of constantly returning to what our primary questions are. And seeking in the different teachings and suttas and elsewhere, voices that really speak to those questions. And I found that over the years, there are certain texts, particularly, not only from the Zen tradition or from the Nagarjuna, but primarily for me now from the Pali Canon itself, that really seem to be speaking directly to the heart of this question. And they're the texts that really speak to me. There's a great deal in the canon that doesn't, if I'm entirely honest. When we read through the early suttas, suttas means discourses of the Buddha, a lot of them are in fact seem to be concerned with issues that were current maybe in the Buddha's time but no longer have a great deal of relevance to us now. So for example, we find a lot of the language is couched in terms of rebirth, of reincarnation. And the way, in fact, the way that the process of awakening is understood in terms of how many lifetimes more you will have to keep practicing before you attain liberation. So you have the once returner, the non-returner. In other words, a person whose practice will only need one more human rebirth to complete itself, as opposed to those who will never have to get reborn. Now, what do we do with that kind of language? It's not as though it just occurs here and there. It runs through the entire course, not only of the early canon, the suttas, but also of all the later Buddhist traditions. And this is a question that is very divisive amongst practitioners of the Dharma. Some people will say, oh, we don't have to bother about that stuff at all. It's irrelevant. It has to do with ancient India. We can understand the world differently today. I can just do my practice. And then there'll be others, possibly the majority of Buddhists, who would find it quite offensive if you suggest that you can dispense with these ideas. You don't have to believe in reincarnation or the law of karma or different realms of existence. For most traditional Buddhists, this is simply part and parcel of what the Buddhist tradition is about. Always has been. And I really can't get why you would even have a particular problem with it. But for many people who've grown up in modernity, like myself, I find these ideas extraordinarily difficult to, certainly to take literally. But even, I think, to interpret them symbolically is always not terribly easy either. And I think what the way that I somehow come to terms with this is to try to get out of the idea that this question of, say, reincarnation is a sort of metaphysical question. Either there is or there isn't. It's either true or it's false. And I wonder, in fact, whether that's actually the wrong way to go about the whole process. Are we actually taking these classical Indian doctrines as somehow mirroring a state of affairs in the world that actually exists, or might we look at it otherwise? And that otherwise would be to say, how did these ideas work? How did these ideas function in the kinds of society that Buddhism has flourished in up to now? In other words, to look at their function in the society rather than to ask whether they're true or false. Do you see the difference? I think this is I found this to be very helpful. And what I think the basic function of a lot of these classical Buddhist beliefs is to provide oneself with a sense of a life that operates within a cosmos. Now, using the word cosmos, not in a sort of hippy-dippy kind of, hey, it's cosmic man sense, but cosmos in a sense of a greater order. Cosmos in Greek is the opposite of chaos. Chaos is without meaning, without structure, without order. Cosmos is an ordered, a coherent sense of the whole in which, whole, W-H-O-L-E, in which we pass our lives. And the traditional cosmos of both Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism has been the cosmos of multiple lifetimes, which are governed by a moral law of cause and effect, which we loosely call karma. And this has the function of locating a person's life in something that transcends their individual existence of 50, 60, 70, 80 years on earth. It locates you within a bigger picture. And that, I think, is more important than getting drawn into these rather, I think, probably futile discussions as to whether reincarnation is true or real or not. And this then leads us to ask, well, do we need that view of the world in order to effectively inhabit a cosmos that transcends our own particular existence? I do think that the practice of the Dharma is far more than just making me feel happier, for example, giving me some sense of well-being. I think it's quite a diminishing of the Buddha's teaching to present it as just a kind of recipe for happiness. That, I think, is almost hedonistic. It's a very narrow point of view. But the Dharma, I think, if it takes the question of birth and death seriously, also has to take seriously that our birth and our death happen in an extraordinarily complex and a long period of time that has given rise to this particular kind of organism, and will continue to exist long, long after our own death. Now, I would argue that the worldview that we have of the natural sciences, starting with the Big Bang, the evolution of life through natural selection on at least this planet, and our current sense of how the Earth and the biosphere and the universe, in a sense, will continue to evolve and develop after our deaths, offers us likewise a sense of a cosmos, and not an indifferent, cold universe, but one in which we bear responsibility for our actions now, in terms of how they will play out, how the repercussions of our actions will continue to have effects long after our deaths, both as as individuals and as societies. So I believe that this particular worldview we have is entirely adequate to the practice of the Dharma, because it is a cosmos that transcends our own particular existence, one which gives us, I think, a very powerful story of how human beings evolved over huge lengths of time, and also, particularly in the light of climate change, global warming, and so on, a sense of how we bear responsibility now for those who will come after us on this planet and will have to live with the results of our actions. To me, that's adequate. Now, I'm going to give you an example from the Pali Canon of a text that I feel rather supports this view of karma and the life that preceded and will follow our deaths. This is a dialogue with a wanderer called Sivaka. We don't know much about Sivaka. He's called Mollya Sivaka. Mollya means head knot. So he was a sort of sadhu or ascetic who had his hair done up on a knot on his head. He appears twice in the suttas. This is one example. There's one other occasion in the Anguttara Nikaya where he shows up as well. But that doesn't really matter. So the interesting thing with Sivaka is he's not a Buddhist, at least in this initial exchange, but he's a curious, inquiring man, possibly like many of us today, who are looking for some kind of answer to the questions of life. And he comes to the Buddha and he says, Mr. Gautama, that's the way non-Buddhists address the Buddha, Bo Gautama, Mr. Gautama. There are some wanderers and priests who hold the opinion that whatever a person experiences, be it pleasant, painful, or neither, is caused by what was done in the past. What do you say about this? Okay. Now, whatever a person experiences refers to our subjective experience of pleasure or pain, or that which is neither pleasurable nor painful. In Buddhism is technically called Vedana. And when I was trained as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, it was understood that Vedana are subjective hedonic or feeling tone is something that is the result of our previous actions. And curiously, this is exactly what Sivaka is asking the Buddha. Of course, with the benefit of hindsight, we can say that Sivaka is saying, what do you think about this orthodox Buddhist view, Mr. Gautama? It hadn't become an orthodox Buddhist view, but he was asking the same question. And this is the Buddha's answer. He says, some experiences, Sivaka, are caused by bile, some by phlegm, some by wind, some by all three together. Some experiences are caused by the change of seasons, some by poor care, some by sudden assault, and some are the fruit of one's actions. And it fits rather uncomfortably with a lot of standard Buddhist teaching. So I think what this shows is that when we go back to the early texts, we find passages like these that actually conflict with orthodoxy and almost jump off the page at us as offering an entirely other way of looking at, in this case, the doctrine of karma. So, to me, this gives a kind of an opportunity to start to rethink some of these primary Buddhist ideas from the ground up, to to go back to these kinds of source materials and to have, in a sense, a foundation upon which we can begin to rethink the Dharma for our time. Now, one thing that we've learned from Christian scholars, biblical scholars in particular, is a system of interpretations whereby we can arrive at greater or lesser degrees of confidence in a text being original. In other words, which passages from the Gospels can we, with greater confidence, regard as perhaps going back to Jesus, and which would have come along later. And likewise, I think we can use the same principles in our understanding of the Buddhist teaching. Now, one of these principles is called the principle of discontinuity. In other words, if a text states something that is discontinuous with orthodox, in other words, it doesn't repeat what the orthodox view is, it's more likely to be more original. And the reason for that is quite simple, because it simply would not have served in anybody's interest at a later date, when orthodoxies were established, to introduce such a view. In other words, there would be no point, it wouldn't have had any benefit to anybody to make it up later. And I think when we go back to these texts, we can find a number of examples of passages like this, which seem to be somehow radical, not in the sense that they contradict Buddhist orthodoxy, but because they go to the very roots of what makes the Buddha's teaching distinctive, what makes it stand out from the culture of his time. There's nothing in this passage here that you could derive from Brahmanism or the Upanishads or from the Jains. It's a very peculiar passage that speaks, I feel, very strongly to the originality of the Buddha's vision. Maybe we could look at some other examples too, but I don't want to get too far down this track because it can get quite technical. But let's just try to summarize. I think what happened in the development of Buddhism from the Dharma that the Buddha taught, and I don't think of the two as synonymous at all, is that what started out as a kind of anti-metaphysical pragmatism turned into a truth-based metaphysics. In other words, Buddhism evolved as a religion into a set of beliefs, in other words, an agreement that certain propositions about the nature of reality that we find in the text attributed to the Buddha as being true. And enlightenment means to accord one's own mind with the truth of those statements. So, for example, Buddhists would say that the ultimate nature of reality is emptiness, let's say. This is a metaphysical truth claim, or perhaps a better known one, the origin of suffering is craving. These are propositions that claim to be true for all time and to describe the very nature of reality itself. And if your practice is based upon belief in those sorts of claims, then you have, as it were, adopted a metaphysical foundation for your practice. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. Clearly, that's what many people have found to be of enormous benefit in their lives. But my sense is that it actually parts company with what was so distinctive about the Buddha's teaching in the first place. And the example I gave with this dialogue with Sivaka, it starts basically by saying there are some priests and wanderers who hold the opinion that whatever a person experiences is caused by what was done in the past. That is a metaphysical view. In other words, to say, if you experience pleasure, pain, or neither, that is the result of what you did in the past. That's a generalized claim that seeks to describe what the nature of reality in this regard is. And the Buddha doesn't go along with it. Instead, he turns his attention to our actual specific, or his actual specific experience, and picks it apart. And says, this is something you can analyze, you can understand, you can find out for yourself, and if not, other people, wiser than yourself, can give you guidance here. So what I mean by anti-metaphysical pragmatism is that the Buddha was concerned primarily not with accessing what we might call the truth, but he was concerned with engaging in a way of life, in a practice that would actually make a difference to the quality of our life. In other words, he's interested not in questions of truth or falsity, of what's real or what's not real. He's interested in how we can change our lives such that we're no longer caught up in the cycles of thought and behavior and attachments and fear that prevent us from flourishing fully as human persons and as human societies. My understanding, and I'll explain this more tomorrow on the workshop, is that he was concerned with a practice that enables us to perform a certain set of tasks rather than achieving a kind of detached, enlightened vantage point that sees things as they really are. Now, this is a tension that runs right through the tradition, and I think it's a very important tension. And let me give you another example. This is perhaps the most famous example of the Buddha's pragmatic and therapeutic approach. He says, imagine a man who's been shot by a poisoned arrow, and the guy is lying on the ground bleeding to death, and his friends try to bring a surgeon to extract the arrow. But the man says, no, I won't let you touch this arrow until I know the name of the person who shot it, the kind of arrow it was, the sort of feathers on the arrow, where, what sort of bird they came from. The Buddha teases it out ad absurdum. And of course, that would be an absurd thing to do. The important point, the only important point, is to get rid of the arrow, to take out the arrow. And the Buddha says, likewise, if somebody says, I will not practice the Dharma until I know whether the world had a beginning, whether the world has an end, whether the world is finite or infinite, whether mind and body are the same or different, whether the Buddha will exist or not after death. And only then, when I've got clear answers to that, will I engage in your practice. Now this is a very clear, very famous, I'm sure most of you have heard this story. It's, I think, an extraordinarily important parable that illuminates what was distinctive in the Buddha's approach. Now, I remember coming across this, these unanswered questions, as they're sometimes called, shortly after I became involved in Tibetan Buddhism in Dharamsala in the early 1970s. And again, I read them in an English language book on Buddhism. I was very struck by that particular teaching, and asked my Tibetan teacher to explain that. And he says, well, actually, in Mahayana Buddhism, we found the answers to all these questions. That we know that the world has no low beginning and no end, like We know that the mind and the body are not the same. We know that the Buddha will exist after death. Now, that is a good illustration, I think, of how one starting out as a pragmatic therapeutic approach mutated, not deliberately, but probably just through the force of habit and inertia, into a set of doctrines that actually claim to have the answers to all these things. But that's missing the point. The point is not that the Buddha didn't know the answers to those questions or knew them and wasn't going to tell for some reason. The point is that those questions simply had no relevance or pertinence to what he was teaching. That they were completely beside the point. He was concerned, how do you remove this poisoned habit? What do you do? It doesn't really matter what you believe about these big metaphysical questions. There's another famous statement where he says, I do not dispute with the world. Of that which the wise of the world agree upon as existing, I too say that it exists. And of that of which the wise of the world agree upon as not existing, I too say that it does not exist. Now again, this is a very striking passage, and one that I feel points very much to the fact that whatever the current view of the world might be, whatever is upheld by those who are considered to be wise or experts in their particular fields at a given time, that's good enough. We don't, there's no need to dispute that. I do not dispute with the world. In other words, that whatever the worldview happens to be, if it's formed on the basis of intelligent inquiry and examination and so forth and so on, that'll do. We don't need anything else. So if we run the rather hackneyed thought experiment, if the Buddha was alive today, would he still be teaching reincarnation and past lives and different realms? I would suspect not. He would simply go along with what the wise of the world today accept to be the case. Because it's not because he agrees that that is the nature of reality. That's again a question he's not interested in. What he's interested in is a framework that is adequate for the performance of these tasks. These tasks of understanding suffering, the first one, letting go of reactivity or craving is the second, experiencing the stopping of craving, the third, and the fourth task is cultivating a way of life, the Eightfold Path, that is made possible when craving stops. That, in a nutshell, I feel, is what constitutes the Dharma as a practice that has really no need for a metaphysical underpinning to believe that the world is a certain way. I'm going to stop there. I hope some of these meandering thoughts have been of interest to you. I'm very preoccupied with these things, as you can probably hear from what I'm saying. And much of this material will be published in a book that will come out in the autumn, which will be called After Buddhism. And there I try to sketch in much greater detail some of these points, some of these arguments that I've been making this evening. So if you're interested in following up on any of those points, then you might find that book to be of interest. But we have another half hour or so before 9 o'clock, which is the time We will close, and I'd be happy to respond to any comments or questions any of you might have.
Yes.
So if I understand this correctly, and please correct me if I've got wrong. The Pali, in the Pali Canon, which is arguably the most authoritative scripture that we have from those teachings, he did advocate reincarnation. Is that right?
I wouldn't use the word advocate. I would say that, you see, one of the curious things with Isa, let's try to phrase it. Advocate is not the right word. There's no, I can't think of a sutta in which the Buddha advocates reincarnation. In other words, he says, okay, because reincarnation isn't what it is. He doesn't do that. He takes it as part of the intellectual, cultural landscape of his time. It's a given. I think it was no different from today. If I'm giving a talk and I refer to the Big Bang and evolution and DNA and all this stuff, everybody just goes, oh. That is our framework. We may not be scientists, we may not have a clue, like me, I don't know. I could not persuade someone who didn't believe in natural selection. But I know nothing about it, I take it on trust. That's the worldview in which we culturally operate. And some people might reject it, that they would be somewhat marginal. Most people just go along with it and take it for granted. It's good enough, it works for most purposes. I think reincarnation and karma have a similar, if not identical, role, not just in India, but in the ancient world. In other words, this idea of going from one life to the next, and the quality of life being determined by the quality of your acts, you find in Plato, Socrates, Pythagoras. It was a standard understanding in the ancient Greek world as well. So it was characteristic of the ancient world. And I suspect it had its origins in the experience of agrarian communities who witnessed, year after year, the first shoots of the plants in the spring, they're growing into, they're bearing fruit, and then the plants die in the autumn, and then winter was nothing there in the spring. It recurs again. This is a cyclical view of life, probably based on agrarian experience. And again, when they talk of karma, they talk of seeds of karma that ripen. These are all agrarian metaphors. So I suspect it's a view of the world that emerged quite naturally from the agrarian culture, which was still very much the livelihood of the majority of people at that time. And the Buddha took it on board. He probably believed it. Who knows? However, one of the curious things that is missing in the Pali, in the discourses, is any attempt by the Buddha to explain how that works. He doesn't give an answer to the, he's not even asked, nor does he give an answer to the question, what is it that is reborn? What is it that survives physical death? Now, in order to claim that you will be reborn, you need to be able to explain what it is that is reborn after the body is gone. There's a passage in the Samyutta Nikaya where the Buddha goes so far as to say that anyone who believes that consciousness will survive physical death and continue into another life is completely mistaken. He actually denies that possibility. For him, consciousness is something that emerges out of a body, an environment, and an interaction between the body and the environment that generates consciousness. That's the classical view. So if the body is gone, the core condition for consciousness disappears too. So although he speaks within the framework of reincarnation, he doesn't advocate it, and in fact many of the teachings seem to go against it. The idea, for example, that there is no permanent self, that the self is continuously in flux. Very difficult to understand how that can somehow survive the death of the body and the brain.
So if you have doctrines such as reincarnation and karma, which, and again, these are quite misunderstood, are tenets from external factors which have been absorbed into Buddhist teachings, for want of a better phrase, due to socio-economic circumstances at the time when the Buddha was giving his teachings. And those tenets have survived up until this point in order to explain certain things that are a fundamental misunderstanding of the Buddhist teachings. How do we reconcile this with practitioners in the current age who, for example, may follow Tibetan Buddhism, where there are still tenets that are very much believed, integral, and alive? His Holiness the Dalai Lama talks about reincarnation frequently. He talks about the doctrine of karma when he talks about karma. As with most lamas, it is your every action has a repercussion, and so is it can't exceed. So how do you marry up the two? Because effectively, what I'm hearing is that the Dalai Lama's quite wrong, which is quite a big thing to come up
with. Well, we can look at that in a number of ways. I mean, why do you idolize the Dalai Lama? I think we must be a little bit careful, and the Dalai Lama, I think, would be the first person to agree with this, that you shouldn't just take something on trust because some authority in a religious tradition says so. If the Pope says something, well, depending on which Pope, we probably wouldn't have the same authority as if, let's say, the Dalai Lama says it. I greatly respect the Dalai Lama, and without his example, I probably would not have even got into this stuff. But again, I don't think it's a question of being right or wrong. I think that's too simplistic. The Dalai Lama is the his role in life is to preserve Tibetan Buddhist culture in exile, where it is under threat in its home country. That is his purpose. That's very. I have no issue with that whatsoever. So it's not a question of being right or wrong, it's a question of him fulfilling his role and his duty for his people in a diaspora situation. But I think perhaps the more important point is that we tend to muddle up karma and rebirth as though they're just sort of almost interchangeable. Karma and rebirth almost comes out as a single word. Whereas in fact they're logically two entirely different things. And the purpose for rebirth is to provide a vehicle for karma to be able to play itself out in some future point in the past. And so what all the different Buddhist traditions did, without exception, is to come up with some theory as to what it is that gets reborn. But none of these theories you'll find in the early texts. The Tibetans believe that what is reborn is called extremely subtle mind and energy that's in the heart center. And that's where everything dissolves to a death. That then gets reborn into a fertilized ovum or something. I find that extremely difficult to understand what on earth that might mean. But it's again a bit beside the point. The important point is the karma, is the actions. And the fact that our actions have consequences after our death, I've got no problem with that. But I don't see the need for me or some version of me to be around when it happens. That the consequences of one's actions can carry on without you. I mean, just think of someone like who's had a great influence in human history, like the Buddha, for example, or Hitler. Their actions continue to have repercussions now, even though they are no longer here. I don't find an issue with this.
Well, then when do you become enlightened?
Yes, you don't have... What do you mean by enlightened? Enlightened about what?
Well, when do you attain a higher mental state or being? Because surely the whole tenet is that you have precious human rebirth after precious human rebirth, which is what you're hoping to attain, in order in one lifetime to attain enlightenment. But all of the effort and all of the good karma that you hopefully generate in each lifetime, which is subsequently carried over by whichever means and vessel, that's when you ultimately, I mean, yes, enlightenment happens in one lifetime, but if you're saying there is no, and I know this is very simplistic, if you're saying there is no rebirth, then everyone has to achieve enlightenment, theoretically achieve enlightenment in one move now. Yeah, this is it.
That's a very good idea. But again, you said
you practice in order to go through all of the realms, in order to. You can clearly tell from the way I'm talking that I practice Tibetan,
yeah,
because
sure.
That's clearly where I'm coming from. But if there is no rebirth.
You see, I mean, this enlightenment is a word we throw around. And I asked you, enlightened about what? That to me is the interesting question.
The meaning of why we're here.
The meaning of why we're here. Well, that, yeah, I find that quite a good definition. But I think this enlightenment or awakening, I think, is a more exact translation. If you look at the conclusion of the Buddha's first discourse, he says, as long as my knowledge and vision is not entirely clear about this fourfold task, as I call it, which I sketched, I could not consider myself to have attained a peerless awakening in this world. So in other words, it has to do with performing a particular task to the best of one's abilities and optimizing the quality of one's life through the realization of those practices. Whether or not you then continue into another life as a consequence of that is an entirely different matter. I'm not saying there's no rebirth. I don't know. If I'm entirely honest, I don't have a clue. I think it's very unlikely, given what we know about the human organism, the brain. I can't make much sense of it. But again, I don't think this practice is something that I've ever done because I'm concerned about evolving into a higher state of enlightenment in some future point after my death. I'm concerned entirely with how to live fully in this world, in this life, now. And if there is rebirth, I can't think of a better way to prepare for it. And if there's not rebirth, I can't think of a better way to live fully here and now. And that we'll find in the suttas.
Isn't that a bit like hedging your bets? Like,
ask
when
God's
you have a car accident and then you immediately start praying to God because you just had a car accident. Isn't that a bit like saying, well, I practice just in case there's a rebirth?
I'm stating that theoretically. Personally, it's not an issue for me. I've spent an awful lot of time struggling with these ideas, and I've got to the point where, to me, rebirth is completely irrelevant. It's not, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it does exist. I just don't think it matters. Yes.
It kind of follows on from what you've been discussing right now, slightly different. You mentioned climate change and global warming, mm-hmm. And I'd like to ask you to speak of your understanding of our current environmental situation in relationship to Pratityasamutpada, co-independent origination, amongst a number of other translations, and karma. How do you view that?
Well, I think the most useful source on this is the Buddha's third sermon or discourse, which is called the Fire, Discourse on Fire. And where he basically says, everything is burning. The eyes are burning, the ears are burning, the tongue, the nose, the body, the mind are burning. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, bodies, thoughts are burning. Burning with what? burning with greed, burning with hatred, burning with confusion. Now, I find that not only a very powerful metaphor for how our lives, in a sense, are being consumed by these fires. He calls greed, hatred, delusion fires. Later tradition calls them poisons. But they're called the three fires in the early sources. And he sees that the world is on fire. Now, that has, I think, rather striking resonances with what we would now consider to be literally the temperature rising. And they talk of this tipping point of 2 degrees Celsius and above. And the reason that the world is literally heating up on fire is because of our greed, in other words, industrial consumerism, capitalist consumerism, which seems to be, frankly, almost unstoppable in the terms of the economy we have today. In terms of hatred, which I would take as a symbol for the development of the build-up of armaments, the build-up of industries based on fear and security, and confusion. In other words, a failure to actually understand the basic law of cause and effect in this case, to not really to understand conditioned arising or dependent origination. So I would take the issue of climate change as a very vivid contemporary example of what the Buddha understood all of those hundreds of years ago to be the consequences of greed and hatred and confusion. If we let our lives be dictated and determined by those powers, then we're going to literally burn the world up. So, I'm not the sort of person to say, well, the Buddha had some vision of the future, but maybe he had a deep intuition as to the destructive nature of these emotions, of these drives, and their instinctive drives. I mean, greed, hatred, and delusion are basically the forces that have been selective in enabling us to get to where our race currently is. And now they're kind of past their sell-by date, but their potency is such that they keep us moving, almost without control into further, take the word consumerism. Fire consumes. There is something, again, implicit about consumerism itself. It's burning us up. It's eating things up. It's destructive. And so if you take that very early Buddhist text and then use that as a way to reflect upon our current situation, I think it's quite illuminating. But of course it's also enormously challenging, because all of us are beneficiaries of capitalist consumerism. We all enjoy standards of living that previous human generations could not have even dreamed of. And although we might support the Green Party or recycle plastic bags or something, are we really willing to take a change, a lowering of our living standards? Are we really prepared to live simply and wisely in a way that could seriously affect what we now sort of take for granted as our birthright, almost, that we have access to whatever we want to eat, we can travel wherever we want to go, we can invite people on planes and fly them across the world. So that's how I look at it. I think there is Buddhism has a great deal to say to us. But I think it has to get out of the idea, for example, of reincarnation, to recognize that the future, our future reincarnations, if you like, are those sentient beings who will have to live on an earth that we are making less and less comfortable. And our responsibility must be with that. If you go to, again, a text that the Dalai Lama teaches endlessly called the Bodhicaryamrita, if you look at chapter 8 of that, he says that it is one person who dies, it is another that is reborn. In other words, the only legitimate motive for working for your future reincarnation is compassion. Because the person who gets reborn isn't you. The person who gets reborn is as different from you as I am from you. In fact, many Buddhist teachers, like Ajahn Sumedho, for example, presented it that way. That we're reborn each moment at some level. And after our deaths, the continuity of our DNA, or whatever, genetic continuity, will give rise to other forms of life. But actually, I think that's missing the point of what reincarnation is actually about. Reincarnation, or the word in Pali is Pungabha, which is the same as in Tibetan Yansi, which means repetitive existence, again become. And so in other words, reincarnation is not just a way of talking about continuity, and continuity that then allows for new possibilities. That's actually not what the doctrine of reincarnation is addressing at all. Reincarnation is basically the problem. Reincarnation is that which one seeks to free oneself from. And in that sense, I think it's more helpful to think of reincarnation, if we are to think of it symbolically, is to think of it as the repetitive habit patterns that are operative in our own lives, in one instance, are operative within social and communal situations. Communities keep repeating the same behaviors and keep experiencing the same consequences. We keep repeating the same patterns of attachment, aversion, fear, etc., and we keep finding ourselves getting into the same mess as we did before, but that doesn't prevent us from just doing the same stuff again and again. So to me, reincarnation is a way of talking about repetition and about the reinforcement of repetition over time. And in fact, reincarnation is a metaphor really for trying to keep things the same, actually. So liberation or freedom in Buddhism, whether you believe in reincarnation or not, is about liberating yourself from the compulsive force of habit and condition. And that can occur moment to moment. In other words, when I'm sitting in meditation, when I'm giving a talk or whatever, I can experience those impulses or those habits that move me to just take the easiest option, to repeat what I'm most familiar with. Or I can choose to act differently. I can choose to think and speak and act in a way that's not conditioned or determined by my instinctive or culturally conditioned habit patterns. In those moments, we experience the freedom of nirvana. Nirvana just means those moments when greed, hatred, and delusion are no longer operative. Even if it's only for a few seconds. That is the freedom from record. That offers the possibility of a life that is not conditioned by those repetitive habit patterns. So I think it's important to recognize that Pungaba, reincarnation, rebirth, repetition, however you translate it, is a metaphor for what it is that prevents us from living both individually and communally in a way that realizes our full potential. It keeps us going round and round in circles. It's a Teufel's Kreis, a devil's circle, a vicious circle. That's the real problematic, and the root of that problematic is what's going on in our experience right now. So your idea of enlightenment or liberation or whatever is a possibility in each moment. And it's a possibility that all of us have the capacity to awaken or not.
Might it be fair to say that you awaken to the Four Noble Truths then? Because if you awaken to that, then you solve the problem of reincarnation.
Yes, I mean, basically that's, I have difficulty with the expression Noble Truth, but let's let's stick with this. Yeah, you see, the Buddha's declaration of awakening was basically his declaration that he understood the Four Noble Truths. Although it doesn't actually say that. He doesn't say understand the Four Noble Truths. He says to understand suffering, let go of craving, experience nirvana, and bring into being a way of life. Because each truth actually needs to be engaged with in a very specific way. And that often gets forgotten. If you set up truth as a kind of synonym almost for reality, then to understand it, you need some sort of cognitive insight into the nature of truth. The Buddha doesn't use the word truth in this way. I mean, we might get into this a bit tomorrow.
You use the word task.
Yeah, I use the word task.
Then to replace that with task would it work?
That would be,
be awakened to the Four Noble Truths.
Absolutely. And that is quite explicit as the conclusion of the first discourse. To be awake means to have recognized, performed, and accomplished those four tasks. So I see awakening not as an end state, but as a process in which we're already engaged, and the practice is to live from moment to moment in an awake rather than an asleep way. And that's a possibility that we can succeed at and fail at in every moment. So yes, that is exactly how I would understand.
I'm
wondering about
the secular dimension.
Secular
dimension. And it's often seen running parallel with rationality. And you're talking about tasks. I'm finding myself wondering about inspiration and how maybe turn to the religious for some people you love, some inspirational, something erotic. I like your idea, Stephen, but I'm sort of thinking this sounds actually waking myself up in the moment. Would it be lovely to inspire? So you're talking about the Dhamma or the Dhamma. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by the Buddha as an inspirational figure?
Well, for me, the Buddha is a hugely inspirational figure. And the book that I will have publishing in the autumn is, half of it, is a biography of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that we can't really understand the Dhamma unless we can understand how it operated and how it was practiced and how it was understood in the life of this particular person. See, the Buddha has been turned into a god, probably for reasons that you suggest, that that the divine figure of the Buddha can be enormously inspiring. But personally, I don't find that terribly inspiring, whereas I find the study and examination of the Buddha's life on earth, what he said, what he did, what he achieved in the context of his time, that is inspiring. And the more I go into that, the more that I get a sense of who this man was and what he did, I find that extraordinarily moving.
Inspired by the hero.
Hero?
Do you say he's a hero?
Yes, I suppose. I mean, the Buddha for me is, without a doubt, the person who has lived on this earth, who has had the greatest impact on my life. Not just the historical Buddha, but actually many of the figures from within the tradition, and also figures outside the Buddhist tradition. But what really inspires me are examples of how a human life could be. And whether we take Nelson Mandela or the Dalai Lama or the Buddha, in some sense doesn't matter too much, but the kind of the prototype, the archetype for that possibility of living a life that's not determined by reactivity and habit and self-interest, that finds for me its fullest portrayal in the life of the historical Buddha. But of course, in many other things too. And so, yeah, that's important to me. I mean, if we think of Buddhism as focused around three core values, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, they're equally important. And Buddha, of course, doesn't just refer to historical Buddha. It refers to any person who has realized such an awake condition. The Dharma is the practice itself, really, the teaching and the practice. And the Sangha is the community who supports that process. And both the community and the Buddha, or the, you know, the living examples of that condition, are indispensable in this practice. Otherwise, it would just be a kind of a philosophy, a sort of health, self-help system. And I'm aware that there isn't a common criticism that I get, is that I'm sort of taking out the numinous or the sacred or whatever. And perhaps in some ways I am. And that's possibly a reflection of my own background as well, not having been brought up in a religious environment whatsoever. But I'm also aware historically how Buddhism has tended to shift more and more towards forms of religiosity. And I think, whatever it may have gained in that, I think it often has lost in terms of a deeper and richer appreciation of humanity. And I feel that Buddha, in a sense, is in a sense a human. He's concerned with the human. He's concerned with what a human being can become. And I don't think he thinks of himself as anything other than a human being who has realized the potential of his or her own humanity. But I find that inspiring. And I personally find words like numinous and so forth problematic. They don't resonate with me very much. Now, the word that works for me is sublime, sublimity, which is more of an artistic, probably a poetic. But I think it's crucial that whatever one's language might be, that one's practice has an element of transcendence. By transcendence, I don't mean the transcendent, some hypothetical ultimate, but transcendence more as a verb. How can I go beyond? How can I transcend what limits my existence, what keeps me stuck within fixed patterns of thinking and speaking and behaving? And any person who, in a sense, embodies the possibility of such transcendence is inspiration. Okay, it's 9:05. Do you have a question?
Really quickly, you mentioned earlier going back to primary texts and the Pali Canon, and the Pali Canon is really, really big.
Yeah, sorry.
What should we read first?
This is a problem. I mean, as you say, the Pali Canon is big. The Pali Canon comes I worked it out, I didn't guess. It's about 8,000 pages of text. We're very, very fortunate as English speakers to have not one, but several translations of it. That's an extraordinary thing. If you're French or German or Italian or Spanish, forget it. You only have fragments. So, where do you start? Well, there are anthologies. Bhikkhu Bodhi has published an anthology called, what's it called? In the Buddha's words. But the trouble is, every anthology will, of course, be selected by a person who has certain preferences. And so you'll get their idea of what really is important. I've put together a brief anthology, which is on my website, under Stephen/study tools. You'll find 40 pages of citations that I've taken from the Pali Canon, some of which are translated by myself, most of them not. And that's called the Pali Canon, the Source Text for Secular Buddhism. But really, this is a work in progress. I honestly don't know where. Well, okay. Read the Sutta Nipata, S-U-T-T-A-N-I-P-A-T-A. That's quite short. It's considered by scholars to be the earliest layer of the Pali Canon. So it has great antiquity. But also short texts like the Dhammapada are really modern. Or the Udana, U-D-A-N-A. These are all relatively short, but very early texts. But to go into the Nikayas requires a certain amount of commitment and patience. It's true, this is not easy material to just sort of pick it up and start reading it. Well, thank you. Some of you are busy tomorrow. Oh, yes. I don't have a piece of paper. Next year, I'm going to get a card. Next year, together with some colleagues, we're going to start a institute called the Bodhi Institute, which is going to offer module-based study courses combined with retreats, as well as a number of standalone week-long programs, which will be focused entirely upon what we call early Buddhism. In other words, the discourses of the Buddha prior to their becoming developed into orthodoxies of different schools. So if you're interested in this project, go to the website, which is bodhi-institute.org. bodhi-institute.org. And that will give you information as to what we're going to be doing. So in the next years at least, I will be focusing my teaching work on these longer courses with smaller numbers of students, going into more depth, primarily into the early discourses, but always from the point of view of a practitioner. So it won't be academic.
Is there a link to that on your website?
There should be. Whether there is, actually I'm not sure there is, but if you Google it, Bodhi Institute, there is an institute in Taiwan called Bodhi Institute, but you'll find that all their material is in Chinese, in which case you've gone to the wrong place. Good night.